This is Dana Lombardi. It's Monday morning at Celesticon 2012. I'm doing the last talk of the War College here on Civil War maps and a project that I'm working on. So what I'd like everyone to do is, because I don't have the PowerPoint on this available, would you all just come on up here to the table and I'll walk you through this, because I have the maps printed out and I'd like to show you what I've done. I'm also, and I don't mean to be insulting, go ahead and grab a chair. Just grab a chair and come on up. I am going to be very descriptive as I talk about what's on the maps, because there's no way for the people hearing this podcast to see the maps. So I'm going to be very, very detailed, even though you're all sitting here going, Dana, I can see what you're talking about. You got a chair here? Okay. So I love the American Civil War. It was the first period of history drew me into history in general. I was 12 years old when the 100th anniversary was being celebrated. There was a game in I think it was Life or Look magazine that we now know Milton Bradley came out with later. It's called 1863. It had like square counters for the infantry. What?
Life magazine.
Life magazine. Life magazine. Triangle for the cavalry and a little gunboat shaped thing for the Union gunboats. And you just move them forward, and it was kind of a goofy game. But for me as a 12-year-old, I was like, wow, unbelievable. This is just so cool. And then that led me into getting into more games and more history, because it was fun. And I've always had an interest in the Civil War. Well, over the years, I'm sure you guys have done the same thing. You collected books, right? You build a library. And one of the most important parts of my library are my reference books on maps. In other words, atlases primarily, but once in a while there's a good book that has a lot of really good maps in it. The trend, though, in the past, like maybe even 30 years with publishers, is that they don't want to spend the money, because it's expensive to put maps in books. And you may notice that there are a lot of books today that don't have any maps at all. How can a history book can have no maps is beyond me. But there's some that have just a few maps. If it does, the author paid for those. Okay, that's very important. So you've got the book author is the one who's out of his pocket is paying for the maps because he thinks they should be in there. My most famous example of that is Peter Hofschauer, who did the two volumes on the German victory at Waterloo. He's German, so he's one of them.
I have the second one.
You have the second one, yeah. So all the maps that you see in those books were paid for by Peter. He's the one that came up with them. And so I said, you know, there's two things here. Number one is that an atlas is just not easy to operate. You know, like the West Point Atlas is, you know, or the Civil War Atlas that accompanied the official records. They did a reprint.
It's like 16 by 12.
Yes, it's like you have this huge book, right? So it's great if you're going to sit there and actually do some reference and everything. But if you're just trying to read casually a book on, say, Fort Fisher or the Appomattox campaign, if that book doesn't have any maps in it, what do you do? You can't exactly lie in bed and sit there or in an easy chair and refer to these other maps. So I said, you know, there's two things about this is that, number one, I love maps. Maps tell a story on their own if they're done well. And number two is that if I do a series that I would like, then it should be done well enough that if you have other books that you're reading, it should give you information that is useful to, say, Shiloh or anything else you're studying. But if you just do a map book, and this is where I'm going to open this up in a second. If you just do a map book, and as always, there's a bunch of maps, it's just another atlas. And that's not very appealing to a lot of people. Maybe somebody who's hardcore like me, somebody who really loves the idea of an atlas, but it doesn't tell a story. There's no story there. It's just a bunch of maps, right? So I said, can you do a book that tells a story with maps? And so this is what I'm going to show you. You're going to see the maps for a book called Grant Rising. And it's going to be Ulysses S. Grant's career, not only the Civil War up through 62, but also his Mexican War and his early life experiences. So what we do is, the first thing you're going to notice is that on the different colors for the two sides, it's basically red for the Confederate and blue for the Union, but you'll notice that there are different shades. Why are we doing that? You'll see on the maps in a second, but one of the things I insisted on was, when you look at a map where everything is red or everything's blue but it's the same shade, there's no way to distinguish who's who. In other words, is this brigade part of this guy or is it part of this division? If it's all the same shade of blue, you can't tell. This is going to be very important when we get to, say, a battle like Shiloh, where the Confederates get intermingled, and the Union does too. It's instantaneously easy to see with shades of blue or shades of red who belongs to whom and why it's a mess. So we start off the book with his life, and where he was born in Ohio, where he grew up, and then where he went to West Point. And you can see his first postings all the way down in Louisiana, because he's going to be part of the campaign in Mexico. And it shows you the United States as it existed at the time. And so this is pretty radical, because most people back then, when they grew up, lived within miles of, maybe at most went to a nearby town or something. But people didn't travel to Chicago. They didn't travel to New York from like the rural areas of the United States. So what convinced Grant as a 16-year-old to go to West Point, because initially he didn't want to go at all. He said, I don't want to go there. He realized, oh my God, I get to travel. I'll get to literally travel this country. And so he got excited. So there's the situation. This is what it looked like then, and these are the places he went to initially. Well, then we go to the Mexican campaign, because, and you can see what happened, because we know the Alamo and we know Sam Houston, and they bit off a chunk of, it wasn't all of Texas. People don't realize that, but the Republic of Texas was just like the eastern portion of what today is Texas. And there was this so-called disputed territory, which is, we're disputing it because we want it. But it was pretty much Mexico. And then there was other areas that we didn't dispute. Okay. So you can see that the campaign and where it went and who was involved in that as an overview. So you have an idea of, and Grant's going to go in across, the border and fight, just near Fort Brown and what is the disputed river line of Rio Grande that still separated Mexico from the rest of Texas. Here is after they fought up near Corpus Christi. They went down and Taylor's force split. It went inland and fought at Monterey and Salcedo, and then Grant and part of it went down and joined Scott's army, and that's where Robert E. Lee earns his spurs under Scott. But Grant and Lee never ever meet. Grant is just a lieutenant, as a company lieutenant in an infantry unit, okay? And Lee is assigned to the headquarters under Scott. So they had no reason to ever cross paths. So some of these guys that Lee later knew about, and therefore psychologically had an edge over in the American Civil War, that's why he didn't know Grant. He had no idea what this guy was like, you know? So anyway, this gives you the and there we are with Scott's campaign. As you know, he went to Mexico City. Santa Anna's trying to block him unsuccessfully, and it just shows basically overall. But it gives you in these maps at least an overview of the Mexican War. So if you ever sit there and somebody says, "What happened? You know, who was going where?" At least you've got a little background that sets the story. And of course, just like the West Point Atlas, on this page is the text that describes what's going on, gives you some anecdotes. And what we're doing is we're telling the story of Grant's career up to this point, but we're using his memoirs and Sherman's and some other people to tell the story. We're not judging it, because you know the latest book out on Grant's memoirs is the fact that the author who wrote this book feels that Grant was unfair to Rosecrans, okay? That he had this hard-on against Rosecrans, and he was going to make him look bad, not only during the Civil War when they got unhappy with him, but everything that was written afterwards emphasized Rosecrans screwed up, he messed up, blah, blah, blah. That all stems from the fact that Rosecrans actually was a very good general, and he had one really bad day. And his bad day wasn't losing. It wasn't the losing. It was the running away to Chattanooga after the Battle of Chickamauga and leaving Thomas behind to hold as long as he did. He became the so-called Rock of Chickamauga. You know, physical bravery was the most important thing for these guys back then. And, you know, you showed by leadership and by doing that you were not afraid of, you know, getting killed. And you had to show that to your troops. So when Rosecrans took off, he thought his lines had collapsed. And in the area he was correct. But Thomas had not yet. And so Rosecrans rides back to Chattanooga trying to rally the troops there, but he's done. His career is finished. And when Grant comes over and takes control, he never has a command. Rosecrans never has a command again. All right, so after the Mexican War, what happens to our hero? Well, he obviously is stationed. This shows the places that he went in Mexico, Mexican War, and then he's back here, and even in the West. We know that, and this is really hard. This is where he becomes an alcoholic. He's stationed in the West, not only in Portland, but in California. Even though he's an officer, he's not allowed to bring his family with him. So his wife and his children are separated. We're not talking months. We're talking years. It's like he can't get leave to go see them, and he can't afford to bring them out, and the Army won't let him bring them out. So it's a very, very hard life on married people. And so, you know, he's drinking. He's drinking, and he gets he becomes an alcoholic in California, and he finally resigns his career. He gets out of the Army, and he goes back home to Illinois, and he tries to become a... You know, he gets there with his family and he tries to do things commercially, and none of those things work out. Fortunately for him, he would have just been another failed, you know, businessman in American history and never even noted by anybody, except that in 1861, guess what happens? Or it's 1860, Lincoln is elected and we have the war. Well, this is what we get to. And this shows you, and it's very dramatic because a lot of times you don't see this, is that you notice we color code the lower southern states that came out first and then the upper states that then seceded. We also know that Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri are very southern sympathizing places, but there's one thing is that people don't realize is that Missouri and Kentucky was thought of by the Confederacy as their states. Okay? And they didn't just make this up because they never ever said Maryland was, even though it was very, very pro-Southern in certain sections. And that's because Lincoln had the legislature arrested. Literally, he arrested it so they could not secede, vote to secede, because there was a rump legislature in Missouri that had left St. Louis and had taken off, and they had voted to secede. And Kentucky, the same thing had happened before they had to bug out, is that they voted to secede. Therefore, legally, Davis and the Confederacy regarded Kentucky and Missouri as southern states of the Confederacy. The reason this is so important is later the winners get to write the story of the war, right? Except, is it an invasion of Kentucky that Bragg launches, or is it a liberation of Kentucky, right? It's an occupied state from the perspective of the Confederates. So you can see that, and you can also see the departments. And why are the departments just, you know, why is that just not an administrative curiosity? That's because, remember, Grant's going to take command down here in Cairo. He's going to be at the southern tip of Illinois where Kentucky joins it, Missouri joins it.
Better call it Cairo.
Cairo. Yep. Anyway, so Cairo. And Grant is going to launch his attack down into Kentucky after the Confederates blow it, okay? Because right now it's neutral. You can see by all these little explosions, there's all kinds of stuff happening in Virginia. And the thing I can't stand is they keep making the maps, even in 61, shows West Virginia as a separate state. No, no, no. It does not become a Western. It's part of Virginia. Why are the Confederates and why is Lee there fighting? That's their territory. And why are the Union doing all this campaigning there? It's because you can see the rail lines going through this. And how important it is. So, but there's nothing in the middle. There's nothing at all happening in Kentucky and Tennessee. Why is that? Because the governor of Kentucky says, we are neutral. And Lincoln's like, okay, we are not going to push these guys. You know, because what happened with the Virginia and North Carolina and the others, as soon as he tried to raise troops and he asked those states to raise troops, bam, they went southern, okay? So he said, okay, we'll respect Kentucky's neutrality. And so initially, so did the Confederates, because nobody wanted to push it. Because Lincoln said, you know, if that goes, we are hosed. If Kentucky becomes, you know, an official Confederate state, we're in deep trouble. What happens, of course, is Leonidas Polk, Confederate commander in Tennessee, not the commander, but one of the commanders on the Mississippi, just can't stand it anymore and decides that Columbus, Kentucky is a too vital city overlooking the Mississippi. And he moves his, without even asking Davis about this, not even telling anybody, moves his Confederate forces into Kentucky. And as soon as that happens, bam, the Union crosses also. And that's when we get to the next phase, because otherwise nothing is going on. And except for an expedition to Belmont, which you're going to see, Grant is not doing anything major. In fact, they're trying to secure Missouri, and there's a whole bunch of operations here. And then Grant is going to, and here's the first, you can see that Grant moves down from Cairo to Cairo to, what do we have there? What is
Paducah.
That? The Paducah. Thank you.
Paducah,
and then
Kentucky.
Sherman, initially, is he takes over for Anderson. Anderson is the guy from Fort Sumter, the commander, but he's so old and ill that Sherman takes over. And, of course, they launch in when Polk comes up and Buckner, Johnston takes over, and they're all, like, moving into Kentucky. Sherman has a nervous breakdown. He absolutely collapses. This is his department. His brother is able to get him this great position. Sherman falls to pieces and is in a hotel somewhere having a nervous breakdown. And so Buell comes in and takes over. And Fremont initially is the commander of the department that Grant is in. But Fremont is a crazy man. Fremont initially says that all the slaves in his area, his department, are free. No, no, no. You can't do that. You know, only the president and the Congress can do things like that. So he wants to replace him, but Fremont won't go. Fremont knows that Lincoln wants to relieve him. So Fremont tells his officers and his staff, don't let anyone in unless you know them. So every time somebody shows up, you know, from the east, they don't let him see him. Well, one young officer, young enough to pull this off, is sent out by Lincoln to relieve Fremont. You have to give him the paper. You've got to do that, otherwise you haven't relieved him. This guy is so young and so not male-looking, right? He dresses as a woman. He dresses, puts on a dress and comes in and says, oh, I'd like to see General Fremont, right? And of course, the guy looks like, you know, goes back and says, General Fremont, there's a lady here to see him. So, oh, yeah, even though Fremont's married, he's definitely known as a womanizer, right? So he says, yeah, let her in, let her in. She comes in and says, I have something for you. And bang, you're relieved, okay? That's how they get rid of Fremont. This whole thing is just wacky beyond comprehension. And Lincoln's trying to deal with this. All right, so they clear out, as you can see, there's all these operations no one talks about, but they have to clear and secure Missouri for the Union, right? And so what happens is that Lincoln's force at Cairo, he's overlooking this, and he's going to do what is supposed to be only a feint. He's just supposed to go and hold the Confederates on the Mississippi in their position so they can't threaten to come in behind the Union forces going into Missouri. Well, here's where Grant shows his attitude, and he's going to do this many times. By the way, this map has never been created. And you notice the different colors? You notice we have the different colors for the different forces, C.F. Smith and Sanderson, and then Grant, and then the guys out in the Missouri. You can see and follow easier what's going on, I think, using this.
That's where I grew up.
That's where you grew up? Wow. Well, it wasn't a battle, but it was cleared out by the Union.
Nope.
Anyway, so Belmont is going to be his first combat. Now, they know that there are Confederates there. There's a camp there. It's across the river from Columbus where Polk has put a lot of artillery. They're blocking the Mississippi. And Grant says, you know what? This is... Let's see what the Confederates got. He has no reconnaissance. He's just like, let's go crazy. So he goes down here, and he's got Tyler and Lexington they're called timberclads, okay? Now, this is very important. What happened is that there's no Navy forces on the Mississippi, none to support the Union, so they literally have to build these from scratch. Well, the easiest thing to do initially is just take riverboats that exist and throw really heavy planking on them. They have no iron yet. So they put these really thick layers of wood on them and put a few guns on them, and they're now timber clads, okay? Now, they will not stop a cannonball, okay? But they'll stop everything else. I mean, they'll stop mini-balls, and they'll stop pistol shots and everything else. So they're sort of semi-armored, all right? And they'll be supporting this group that comes down. He drops the guys off. He's got Darity and McClernand and some cavalry, and the Confederate camp is surprised. You can see the guns in Columbus on the river.
Were those the two same two gunboats that were used at Shiloh?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
I thought that's right.
And there's something you'll see about that later in the maps, too. But anyway, so yes. Now, at the same time that these have been instantly built fast in order to give them some kind of naval power, they're also building real ironclads that are on the river. Okay, and this shows the industrial difference. And it'll be a sidebar on this showing how fast they built these. But they had to get 700 tons of iron manufactured to make these six ironclads. They're the same. They're St. Louis
Pooks.
And the Pooks turtles. These are just big barges, actually, very slow, and they're very heavy, and they don't have the power to push them very quick. But they're armored gunboats, and they're created in just a few months. It's just incredible. They just throw these things. They can bring some guys from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. The Navy, by the way, cooperates so incredibly well with the Army. And you would think that their rivalry, their inter-service rivalry, would be, you know, preventing this. But, man, I got to tell you, you know, old Neptune himself, you know, our Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, and he just steps on everyone and says, we are going to cooperate. Whatever the Army needs, you will give them. And this is very interesting. It's not Navy ships. This is an Army fleet. It's the Army's Navy, okay? But they send the Navy guys, the guy who's the head of the ship, Brooklyn Navy Yard, with all of his experts, and they rush them out there, and they build Pook's Turtles, 700 tons of iron and all these guns, right? The Confederacy, through the entire war, is not going to manufacture 700 tons of iron for their ships, okay? It's just not going to happen. They have to pull up rails and things like this. It's crazy. Which shows the, and that's just one thing that the Union's going to do, right? Because remember, they're building ships out in the Atlantic as well. So this is just an amazing accomplishment logistically. But initially, Grant doesn't have these gunboats yet, these ironclads. And then, of course, he's able to surprise them. They overrun the camp. And the guys go berserk. You know, all green troops, they go berserk. You know, they start stripping the place. They've gotten disorganized. And so the Confederates, they can see this mess happening, and they send Pillow and Cheatham, who are going to be in future battles, across to basically rout Grant's force there. And Grant, to rally his guys, because they're panicking now. They think they're trapped, right? He says, you fought your way in. Fight your way out. Okay. Wow. Okay, that makes sense. And they literally fight their they fight their way out of this trap.
So where are the gunboats against this river crossing?
Do you see the circle, how they're like doing this?
Yeah.
Okay. They cannot stand up against these things. So see how they're sort of sneaking out from this point? They're like bang, 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 bang. They come back there and they reload, okay? And they take out fire, and the Confederates are like, here they come, they're going to fire! You know, and they miss them. They just are not able to, like, hit them. They're far enough away, okay? So it's not really a big, serious fight like there's going to be at Fort Donelson, where there will be a real, you know, toe-to-toe shoot-up of the gunboats.
So the artillery keeps the gunboats at distance, giving this guys a chance to cross.
They're going to be able to cross, right. And that's what happens. They're able to cross, and the Union can't stop it because they only have these two. Mm-hmm. These are the only two timberclads that are built so far, right? So Belmont is a learning experience for Grant, right? He's like, okay, you know, I learned something valuable. And he says this. He says, I realized that the Confederates were just as afraid of me as I was of them. And he realized, you know what, I should not let that dictate everything. It's like we have an advantage by they're just as confused and just as afraid and just as, you know, undecided about what's going on. So anyway, now we see strategically what's happening. In other words, what is the context of all this? Well, you know that in early 62, we're going to have the Fort Donelson campaign, everything. You see the departments again. But we know that there are operations happening along the coast immediately. We know that Farragut is on his way to New Orleans. But what I wanted to emphasize is this east-west rail line is the only one the Confederacy has that is unbroken. okay? In other words, yes, yes, there are different gauges in there. Yes, yes, you have to change trains. But you don't have to, like, march. Like, look at Montgomery. There's no rail line east-west connecting. You literally have to march, like, 20, 30 miles before you can hop on a train again. And this is really, really important. And the reason they did this is they were just building these things to bring in the cotton from different areas to where they could then move them easily on rivers and so forth. So this is the only one, and why Corinth is going to be so important and why Memphis is so important is because this is the only east-west line in Chattanooga that the Confederates have to move stuff easily east and west. And then the north-south, they've got a couple, one out here and one out here, but there's nothing towards the center that easily allows you to do this. Now, here's the situation operationally. See, Buell's color is a different shade of blue from Halleck. Well, when Fremont is replaced, they put Halleck in charge. And we remember Halleck. His nickname was Old Brains. He was a very, very intelligent guy. Had no combat experience during the Mexican War, right? But he still made, again, it's by rank and everything. He is the one put in charge here. He had written the manual, literally, he wrote the manual that guys are using to drill their troops. And Buell is the Department of Ohio. Halleck's got the Department of Missouri. Grant is under Halleck. And what is going on that is just insane is that Halleck cannot stand Grant. Halleck was his commander in California. Okay, Halleck made a bundle. He made a lot of money when he was in California, land speculating. But he knew Grant as a drunk. That's all he knew about the guy, and he was not impressed. And so he was writing and bad-mouthing Grant nonstop. Okay? And the only thing saving Grant is that, remember where's Lincoln from?
Illinois.
That's right. And one of his closest advisors is Elihu Washburn, is a senator who was like Lincoln's closest friend from Illinois, and one of his closest friends, and his one of his closest advisors, right? So they're in Washington. They got all these weird things going on, all these people they don't know, and Washburn is advising Grant, and Halleck is saying, you know, I want to get rid of Grant, and Washburn's saying to Lincoln, I know this kid. I know him personally, and I say, don't listen to Halleck. Leave him at where he is. He's going to do good things. And Lincoln says, okay, fine, because he has other issues to deal with, right? You can also see that Polk, what his force is different color from Tillman, who is in control of the two forks blocking the two most important rivers here, the Cumberland and the Tennessee, right? That's what they're trying to do. And then A.S. Johnson and Hardy and the other guys were spread out. So you can see that where the commands. And this is one of the biggest issues that the Confederates have, is that if you look at Virginia, it's rather compact. Lee doesn't have to spread his troops out or control an area that is huge. Tennessee is a, you know, they did this geographically to make it easy, but geographically it's very difficult for the Confederates to control this. And they don't have as many resources. They're fooling the Union into thinking they do, but the Union, when they finally get going, are going to be able to basically bust through this. Now, there's something interesting about this that everyone needs to remember. How many winter campaigns had the United States ever performed before this?
Zero?
One.
Valley Forge.
Well, it's not Valley Forge, it's Trenton and,
Trenton
and Princeton, right?
Right.
Right. And why did Lincoln, why did Washington do that? He didn't want to do it, but he had to. He was desperate to get some kind of victory or some kind of, and so he did it to surprise the Hessians, right? Mm-hmm. And it worked. But that was it. And normally, now, what was the only winter campaigns before this that people would read about, say at West Point, right?
Eylau.
That was a big success, wasn't it, right? Or the Russian campaign where Napoleon's army is destroyed. So the lesson here is you do not do major operations in the winter, right? Okay. Grant says, screw that. They're not going to be prepared for this. They're not going to be, because Lincoln keeps sending notices out west, and they're all aware of this, is that he's frustrated. Politically, he's got enormous pressure. After Bull Run, okay, fine, there's another rush of enthusiasm and patriotism. He brings McClellan to rebuild the army. He builds this Army of the Potomac, massive force. And there's nothing going on between Bull Run, really, and the end of the year. And so the political papers are just excoriating Lincoln, you know? It's like, this is an expensive thing to keep all these guys in uniform and feed them and everything else. It's costing, like, you know, today they would say the equivalent of $1 billion a day to have our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's the same sort of thing. And Lincoln can't get his generals to do anything, right? And so he's really in despair because politically he's getting kicked to crap because they're not doing anything, you know? And we know it doesn't matter what the reality is that winter operations are not good ideas. And so Grant proposes to Halleck that, you know, I can take my guys down and I think I can take these forts when they're least prepared for it. And Halleck says, well, it's my prerogative to decide when to do this. And then all of a sudden this message comes from Lincoln saying, you've got to do something. Something. And so Halleck's like, ooh, maybe I can get rid of Grant. Maybe I can get rid of Grant. So let us move on to Grant's operation.
Now, at the time, there's a lot of politicking around. There's the possibility of a new state of East Tennessee.
That is correct. And Lincoln knows that because Western Virginia and Eastern Tennessee and Western North Carolina all are filled with pro-Northern, or at least
anti-sympathies.
Unions. Right. Yeah. And Lincoln wants to try and liberate that area in order to, yes. Yeah.
So now, Jefferson Davis, he was a Secretary of War, right?
That is correct.
And he was highly regarded as, like, the most competent
Secretary. Oh, he's regarded as a brilliant man, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, as the most, yeah, it's like, he's the equivalent of Alexander Hamilton in the Treasury.
Yes,
he has
that
kind of reputation. So is part of the dilution of the Confederate forces because Davis is aware of this
yes.
problem.
You have to block the Mississippi because it is a vital thing to do to squeeze the North financially. If the Mississippi is not open, then all of this, you know, grain and corn and all the other things that they're trying to send out, you know, because it's either got to go by rail, which is not that cheap, all the way to the eastern ports, or down the Mississippi, which was the cheapest way to transport it on ships, you know, on riverboats, to New Orleans and out. But that's closed to them, right? So, yes, breaking up the South into its segments would have been a huge boon to the North, and Davis is required, literally, Johnson has an impossible mission. Block the Mississippi, which is your far left, keep suppressed this pro-Northern sympathy in those areas that we occupy, and stop the Union from, you know, invading through Tennessee and everything. Because remember, this is not just militarily important. Davis has his own government that he has to worry about. There are guys, now remember, Kentucky has congressmen seated in the Confederate Congress. All right? What are they doing? They're screaming, my territory is... Yeah,
liberate
my territory.
These.
Right. I have constituents. Hello? You know, why are you abandoning my constituents, right? So Davis has all this pressure on him as well as Lincoln has pressure. All right, but they're finally going to kick it off and go. And here's what happens. Grant does two things, okay? And here's our wonderful gunboats. Remember Tyler Lexington, and now they have the Conestoga. Grant is going to take Foote. Foote is a naval guy under Army control, all right? I mean, the flexibility here between the services is truly wonderful. Anyway, so Grant takes his military. It's the Army in the field of the District of Cairo, okay? Because they don't necessarily call everything in the field an army. It's usually Army in the field of a district or department or whatever they've got. So he's going to go down and try and seize these forts that are blocking the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers. He's also going to launch this raid with timberclads down, and they're going to go down under a Commander Phelps. And you can see that they now have another ship, timberclad ship. So here's what happens. Now, notice, what have we done? I go crazy every time I look at a map, and every ship is always in the shape of a familiar ship with a pointy bow, flat stern. That's not what the Pook's Turtles look like. So if you want to be able to see what the gunboats that are ironclads are separate from the timber clads, not only can you use a color, I mean, my goodness, you're printing in color. Why not use it? Well, why not make them the shape they were, right? So this is the first time, I'm very proud about this, is the fact that we're putting the ships and their distinguishing shapes different on the map so that you can tell which ones are which. And no shock, how are they lined up? The ironclads are in front and the timberclads are protected in the rear, firing over their own ships, right? So Fort Henry was sited very poorly. It's flooded. It just, this is an interesting story.